Imagine, if you will, that you're a designer and you pour your heart and soul into a creation that marries beauty and utility. You might hope that it will be a product that endures. You might then be shattered if it lasted just a moment, if it was swept away by next year's model. Well, welcome to the grinding obsolescence of automotive design. You're about to meet a man familiar with this rough and tumble. He's also the designer behind some of the most exquisite cars in modern motoring history. Think Aston Martin, think DB7, think Vanquish. If that's all Greek to you, well, stick around, we will explain. Ian Callum has been responsible for the design of a slew of award-winning cars. He's been a design director at Ford and Jaguar. And he has recently lurched from retirement, if you will, to create a new design firm, simply titled Callum, and it produces bespoke design products, cars to chairs. The range is almost infinite. Ian, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to meet you.
Can you take us back to your first beautiful car memory? What was it that triggered the sort of designer response from you in a vehicle?
Yeah, I can. It's quite vivid, actually. I'd be about 3 years old, and I would watch the cars go past my house, a little town called Dumfries in Scotland. And I was fascinated in cars. I was also fascinated in drawing things. I love to draw stuff around the house, like, you know, Hoovers and tellies and radios, you know, and they always tend to be mechanically orientated stuff. And I saw a Porsche 356 drive past the house. And remember, in those days, this was a new car. This wasn't some old classic. This was a brand new one. So it just shows how long ago it was. But and I thought, I want to be part of that world. And that was it. The decision was made.
That's such a young age to make that decision.
Yeah, I know. And it's haunted me ever since. I tell you, when things got a little bit tough and I'm not sure I wanted to do this anymore, I thought, well, just think of that little boy. You owe it to him. You've got to do this. And it drove me, you know, that commitment to that age drove me all my life. And so I have to thank that little three-year-old for making that commitment. Then I saw an E-Type. A few years later, my grandfather took me down to a local garage and our dealership in Edinburgh, and there was an E-Type Jaguar. And at that point, I'd be about seven at this point, and I decided I would want to design Jaguars. There's another commitment. So,
well, didn't you submit a design to Jaguar at the ripe age of 13?
Yes, I did. I sent a lot of drawings in to a guy called Bill Haynes, who was the head of engineering. And he wrote back to me, giving me advice how to become a designer. And in fact, we had quite a correspondence. We had two or three letters running between us. And, you know, I still have one of the letters I received from him. And it all sort of makes sense now. It's almost like, you know, the book was written and I was just running through the chapters as life would take me. So it was quite bizarre, really. I feel very fortunate.
What's the most beautiful car that's ever been made, do you think?
Ah, that's a difficult one. A lot of people would say the E-Type Jaguar. I would tend to agree with them, but I'm not going to say that because it's too obvious. My favorite, most beautiful car was the Ferrari 250 short wheelbase. There's something so animalesque about that car and yet so beautiful that I find it irresistible. And in many ways, it wasn't as futuristic looking as the E-Type Jaguar, but it was just such a marvelous piece of visual movement to me. I can never afford one because they're worth about £10 million now.
There's an interesting tension, isn't there, with something like a car, especially ones which are, you know, designed to be bought and driven, a tension between trying to push that envelope of design, but also to produce something which is recognisable to the potential purchaser, is in a design, a visual vocabulary that they can sort of grasp and understand.
Yeah, there's a lot of tension, and you know, you have to remember what the car's there for. It's to be driven, and of course, different cars have different functions. You know, I understand sports cars, and I kind of decided very early on what a sports car was for. It had two functions. It had to be driven, preferably quite quickly, and it had to be admired. You know, that was a function of a sports car, as far as I was concerned. So the aesthetic was very important. When you get into more utilitarian vehicles, such as SUVs and such like, perhaps the admiration stakes are probably not so high, although I try to instill some of them in some of mine. But the tension just grows and grows because you have so many factors now in designing a motor car. Inputs, we call them metrics. It could be anything from cost to, you know, safety, crash requirements, features, quality materials. I mean, there are hundreds of them. And you have to feed them all through the sausage machine, and hopefully you can control it enough to bring some character out at the end of it all.
The thing I mentioned at the beginning here of sort of the turnover in style and shape of cars, I mean, there are notable exceptions to that. I mean, why is automotive design so twitchy? Why do automotive companies continually want to change it up?
Well, there's so many factors involved, including the individuals. It's incredible how powerful the individual designer within a business actually is. You know, the chief designer of a brand has a lot of say in how these things work out or otherwise, but if they're worth their salt and if they're worth anything to the brand, they should be allowed a lot of say. So, you know, each individual has their say in how this brand should move forward and how it should evolve through the next number of years. And hopefully if that designer's good enough, they'll be able to create something which is lasting. The one thing I'm not really sure what you're getting at here, but let me just answer something. I'm often asked, why do cars always look the same? Why can't you make something different? Well, what we forget is that the main factor that drives the shape of the car is a human being. You know, our head at the top, you know, we sit in a seat and probably the most comfortable way to sit in anything, any car, and our feet are at the bottom. And, you know, we want the mechanics of the car to be placed in a relatively safe place. I say relative because, you know, any car can be a dangerous missile driven badly, but it's all about the reality of the components, including the human being, that drive the shape of a car. What me as designers try and do is create some character around these shapes, which are going to be forever very similar until the human being changes shape, which is highly unlikely. So, and it's difficult, but the one thing I do notice is you do get a lot of pressure in some of these larger corporations. I've experienced it myself, where the big boss comes in and says, look, I want something different. Create something that people have never seen before. And then you start to see some rather obscure shapes and sizes come out of cars, which I certainly look at and wonder, where did they come from? You know, and I know they've come out of pressure from, you know, older bosses, probably talking to younger designers who may be slightly naive and creating shapes for the sake of it to try and give their creations a different look. Now, that's fine. I'm happy with that. You know, the world needs an eclectic mix of ideas and designs. But I've always been one that chases beauty and longevity. So, you know, for me, beauty is more difficult than different. And you will forever get cars which look slightly different. The overall shape will be the same, but the detailing will be very different. And I can think of quite a few examples at the moment that are quite baroque in their style, and they've got lots of design, you know, swages and graphics all over them. But in reality, they won't last the test of time because they're actually not very pretty. And, you know, the human eye likes pretty. That's it.
Have you made anything prettier than those Aston Martins we mentioned, the DB7, the Vanquish? They are beautiful cars.
Well, thank you. You know, I worked a long time to create something which, to me, was right. You know, I wasn't looking for the fashion of the time, although there's obviously some influence there. I was looking for something that people would look at and enjoy. You know, it's like a piece of music. And if you create something people can enjoy then, without question, without debate, then that will last the test of time. Yes, of course, they will become old. You know, the E-Type looks old. You know, it's of an era. But you can't deny the fact it's still something that's a beautiful object to look at. And that's what I try to search for and reach for in my designs. And I've been very fortunate. I've worked for brands that could accommodate that. I think the more corporate, bigger volume brands are always looking for that essence of just make it different, you know, so we'll be noticed. Or make it louder. Make the grill bigger. Make the grill bigger. No, bigger. Bigger, bigger, bigger. And, you know, you see that now, you know. We wanted to shout. And that's kind of what happens.
Well, Jaguar itself, I mean, it's an interesting sort of arc design-wise. I mean, the E-Type is an absolute pinnacle, but there's a bit of a trough there, and you know, over several decades for Jaguar, where it struggled to find its rhythm design-wise.
Yeah, I can explain that. And this is something that frustrated me as I was growing up through my younger part of my career. I watched Jaguar, and I grew up with it in the 60s, and dare I say, the late 50s as well. So, you know, I understood the brand then. The XJ6 was born out of Lions, wanted to create the most sporty sedan you could, or saloon car you could possibly imagine. He did in the XJ6. And he understood his aesthetic was always about creating something that was beautiful. It was an extremity of proportion, which made it exciting. I think that sense of excitement was very important. And then the custodians of the brand after that, after he left the business, didn't really know what to do. So all they did was copy the past. And therefore you had this sort of trough, as you say, of Jaguars that looked like the old ones, just continuing for almost 30 years. Hmm. And I could see immediately that was wrong. It's not what Lions would do. And so when I had the chance to go into the business and reestablish the Jaguar brand at the year 2000 thereabouts, I said, right, we're going to go back to our principles of what we're about. We're about beautiful cars. We're about modern cars. The Mark II and the XJ and, you know, and the 120s and E-types, they were very British cars, admittedly. They had a certain style about them. But they were modern cars. And they kind of fell into this lull of being traditional cars and the almost retrospective. So my job was to kind of pull them screaming and kicking into the 21st century and create cars which are relevant for today, which is what Lions would have done. And so we picked up the principles of what they stood for back then, the principles, not to copy them. And really that was my objective when I started on the new range of cars. Round about 2006 it started with the XK, the Jaguar XK. So, you know, it was a difficult job because I had met a lot of resistance internally. The XF was the one that really kind of bit the bullet. And, you know, I look back on it now and that's now almost a classic itself. you know, you're getting old when your cars become classics. So it sort of worked and we've reestablished Jaguar as a brand as part of the 21st century.
Was it important to keep a sense of Britishness about that, though? Is that a hard thing to define and put your finger on?
It is in today's design world. You know, what is British? What's French? What's American? You know, I remember in the 60s, you knew what an American car was. You knew what a British car was. And the emphasis that, you know, they transferred from one nation to another. And you guys know that with Holden. They were influenced by GM in the US, as was Vauxhall here. Ford was influenced by the mothership in the US, but the British cars, ironically, were designed by Italians during the 60s. So, but the point about Britishness, I think the word kind of restraint is the word I like to use. You know, they weren't overly flamboyant. You try to focus on quality of line, quality of shape, and hopefully quality of materials. And that was a sort of Britishness that we looked for, but it's about restraint rather than over flamboyance. And a beauty and simplicity of line. Now, you could argue that maybe an Italian car would fit into that genre as well, but there's something about the British car. They had to look a little bit more solid, a bit more kind of stately, if I can use that word.
That's a good word.
I think the XF fitted that bill quite well. Yeah, you know, I'm sure people would disagree with me, but it doesn't matter. It's done now.
your new project, Callum, I mean, and this is such an interesting thing because it is recognizing those classic things, those classic designs in cars and other objects, but then bringing them up to speed. To tell us about the principles here.
Well, really, this is a kind of catalyst for me. That's not my full-time, long-time intention. You know, I took my Vanquish that I designed many years ago and we've done a kind of revamped version of it because one, it was one of my favorite cars, and secondly, a lot of it wasn't quite what I wanted at the time, and I've learned more since then. So we took a car I was familiar with and we've taken it to another level and it's working well. You know, if that car came out now as we've designed the latest version called the VC25, it kind of would stand its own if you brought it out as a new car. Almost the stance is better, the the power is better, the interior is much better. And so, you know, we're creating something which is of today rather than of 20 years ago. However, for me, it's a catalyst, it's a starting point. The chairs and such like, we're doing other kind of objects of that type. Again, the kind of catalyst towards something that's a little bit more original. But it's better to start with something that you have got some foundation in so that you can control it better. And you can certainly, when you come at doing the real thing, you can control the costs as well. So let's say we're revamping the Vanquish, but hopefully the next car we do will be more than just that. It'll be something a bit more fundamentally all new. I'm hoping. I'm not promising anything, but I'm hoping.
There is an enthusiasm, is there not, though, now for people wanting those classic designs, but with the better automotives, the better mechanics, those modern things under the bonnet and in the cockpit of those cars that comes with what's achievable now. It's makes them a very desirable item.
It does, because what a lot of people don't realise when they drive an older car, not the Vanquish is that old, but sometimes, quite often, very disappointing things to drive. And I think for the average punter who wants something which looks great and traditional, but wants the creature comforts, there's a real hunger for that now. You know, it's got to handle better, the brakes need to be better, the ease of driving it and the goodies in it, you know, the features need to be there. You know, everybody wants a classic car that we speak to. They always have to have a sat nav now. So so we try and plug their iPhone in it somehow. But you know, it's, it's absolutely right. And we've got a great hunger for these, you know, suddenly heritage and the sense of craftsmanship or other words of that ilk. You know, there's a great hunger for these things now, I think, as the world's becoming so digitized that people are kind of craving for that character of the past.
It's that first E-Type that you pressed against, and that Porsche that you saw driving past as a very small boy. Do you still get that sense of excitement in modern design, or is that a thing of that moment, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I do. I do. I still see cars that come out occasionally. Because I'm so steeped in the whole world of it now, it's not a mystery to me anymore, unfortunately. But sometimes something comes out and, you know, it might be a concept, it might be a one-off, that I still get that buzz out of it, absolutely. And I still get the occasional product or vehicle that comes out. I think, wish I'd done that. Which is a good feeling, you know. It's not one of envy, it's just one of, yes, that's good that that's like that, because it means there's still scope.
Ian, thank you. Look, congratulations on such a storied career, and the best of good fortune for the future with Callum.
Well, thank you very much, Tita. It's a pleasure to talk to you and give my regards to Australia. It's a country that I know well and I love very much. So
you worked for Ford down here for a bit, as I understand it.
Yeah, I worked for Ford. My son was born in Melbourne. He's an Aussie, by the way. He lives in New Zealand now, but I'm sure you won't hold that against them.
Ian, thank you. Ian Callum, he's the founder of bespoke design firm Callum, former designer for, well, he's, as he's described, many, many places, Ford and Jaguar among them. This is Blueprint, Radio National.